I'm Greg Johnson. Welcome to Countercurrents Radio. Our guest today is poet Leo Yankevich.
Thank you for having me on.
Leo, I have been a great admirer of your work for years. I remember the first thing I read by you actually popped up on some kind of white nationalist discussion board. It was the poem Tikkun Olam. I read it and I was amazed by it and I filed it away in my mind and then I somehow forgot it. And then once we started Countercurrents, you sent a poem to us about Ezra Pound. Ezra Pound enters the tent. And I remember that name, but I couldn't quite place it. I wrote to you, I remember, and said, are you sure you want to publish a poem with us? And you wrote back, said, yeah, I'm fully aware of what you guys are all about, and I want you to publish the poem. And so that's when I rediscovered your work. And since then, Countercurrents has published two books by Leo. One is Tikkun Olam, the second edition. Our most recent book by him just came out this past November. It's called Journey Late at Night, Poems and Translations. So, Leo, can you give us a little biographical background information before we start talking about poetry?
About myself?
Yeah.
I was born in a small town in western Pennsylvania, Sharon, Pennsylvania, and I grew up in a town adjacent to it, Farrell. And this town is about 100 miles north of Pittsburgh. And growing up in that town, I witnessed the changes, the demographic changes. Our town turned into a prospering steel town into a ghetto within 15 years. And I could see the destruction of the town, the slow sort of like termites eating away at it until all the streets disappeared for obvious reasons. And it was like a microcosm of Detroit. Basically what took place. The town, half of the town is just one big parking lot. So this is what woke me up to the situation that's taking place in America. And I grew up in this. This is the background of my American experience. So I knew what was taking place, but I couldn't quite understand who was behind it. I saw the symptoms of the disease, but I didn't know who was what was the reason for the disease. And that's basically my upbringing in Farrell, basically, form my worldview, my attitude towards everything, though I wasn't conscious of at the time.
So you now live in Poland, so that's a long journey. How did you come to be a resident of Poland, and are you an actual Polish citizen now?
No, I never became a Polish citizen. Actually, I have Lithuanian blood in me, so I'm of Lithuanian ancestry, and the Lithuanian nobility Polonized. That is, they started speaking Polish, but they had a strong sense of identity. So I never really felt Polish. I feel Polish-Lithuanian, which means a Lithuanian who spoke Polish, my family. So anyway, why did I come here? I studied, I went to college, at a college north of Farrell, about 100 miles in Venango County in western Pennsylvania, called Alliance College. And Alliance College had one of the best Slavic departments in the United States. And I started studying history there. And then I also picked up a second major, Polish, because of a girl, obviously. And after 4 years, after my bachelor's degree, after getting it, I had a chance to get a scholarship to come to Poland. And at that time, it was right after martial law. And for me, that was exotic. And so I had a chance to come, and I came in the middle of martial law. When I landed at the airport in Warsaw, there was a young soldier holding a Kalashnikov machine gun in my face. It stunk. It was that the conditions were just terrible. But for me, it was exotic. There was nothing to eat. It was exotic. It was exciting for me at the time, and I wanted to be here. And I was here for a year, and then I went back to the States. I worked in New York City. And then I came back again, and the changes started to take place, and I met my future wife, came back to New York again to work. Actually, know who I worked for? Larry Silverstein in the security business. You know, the World Trade Center.
Yeah,
I actually worked for this guy every day. I actually saw him every day, morning, Mr. Silverstein. But back then, I wasn't aware. As I mentioned, I wasn't aware yet. Anyway, so I got married in 89, and I decided to stay here after that. And I've been here basically, except for a few visits back to the States for funerals. I've been here the whole time. And so I witnessed all those changes, and Poland is completely Americanized, Westernized completely. So it's a different country today.
For better and for worse, I imagine.
For better and for worse, yes, young people are completely demoralized, have no sense of history. There's just a total let's call it niggerization of our, of young people here. They listen to hip hop. My own kids do. I can't stop them.
How many children do you have and how old are they?
I have three sons. The eldest is 23. The second one is 20 and the youngest one is 18. And the eldest just finished his bachelor's degree in economics and soon he's working on a master's degree. And the two youngest ones, I don't know what they're going to do. I don't know if they're going to study or not.
So you are best known as a poet. When did you decide to write poetry? When did you realize that that was your calling in life?
Well, actually, it came about, it was a dilemma I had about 1984, 85. I didn't know if I wanted to be a historian or to move into literature, to become a professor of Slavic literature. And I moved towards poetry. It was easier because alcohol was involved, women, and you could be, you didn't have to be disciplined. And so I moved into that area. And of course, in the beginning, I wrote traditional poetry. And then I realized, like most ambitious people, that you have to do certain things to advance. You have to write a certain way from a certain point of view, which is the modernist point of view, the modernist slant. And after a while, I started to realize that this is all, this is not real art and there's no craft involved. But in the free world, in the modern art world, just like a journalist understands that he has to write about lesbians and poor gypsies or black people, a poet understands at a certain point to get published, he has to write about certain topics from a certain point of view, the political correct point of view. And so around 2001, 2002, I switched back completely to my original style of writing. I started listening to Dr. Pierce. And I switched into this direction. And also, I'd actually written some poems about the Holocaust from the Jewish perspective, because I knew those poems would get published back in the 80s and 90s. But that 2001, I changed. It's completely switched over. I realized that I felt actually guilty that there was nothing written for European people in their defense. And that's when I started in the direction of Tikkun Olam. And I started writing those poems at that time. And of course, I received criticism. I was ostracized, but I loved it. I enjoyed every moment of it. You know, as the National Socialists said, when they call you an anti-Semite, it's a medal on your chest. And so that's the way I look at it. I'm very proud of my my accomplishment in this area, and hopefully I've woken up some people.
Tell me about your poetic influences, and then we'll talk about your political influences. What poets influenced you most?
Probably the early 20th century poets like Yeats, like Dylan Thomas. Of course, that's middle century. Those two poets were my favorite. And a lot of European poets, George Trakh, Rilke. These poets, I think, influenced me the most. Some Russian poets, a few Polish poets. I don't think you know their names. I think European poetry is much better than Anglo-American poetry, which is pretty impoverished. So in the English language, poetry would be Yeats, Dylan Thomas, Roy Campbell, Robinson Jeffers. I've mentioned him to you before. Even though he wrote in free verse, I thought he was just a great poet. I used to carry Robinson Jefferson around with me every day in New York City, and I still have this book with me. He was one of the few free verse poets that had the power to move me. And you admit he was a very powerful poet, Robinson Jefferson.
Oh, yeah, he's an amazing poet. I want to visit his house in Carmel.
That he built with his own hands.
Yes. It's a beautiful place. I've seen many, many pictures of it. And one of the things that I really regret is that when Jonathan Bowden came to California in 2012, we didn't go there. I thought, well, he'll come back in 6 months and we'll take him there then.
The curator, I think that's the proper word in English. I know the person. I've published. Well, I still publish Jews sometimes. In my own magazine, but I make sure I don't let them. It has to be completely neutral. It can't be anything that's negative towards European, anything that promotes homosexuality. But as an editor, I have to do that. I don't publish a National Socialist magazine. I publish a poetry magazine.
Right.
So I'll still publish them, but I will edit. Of course, if they will publish with me, because a lot of people try to badmouth me and put me down. And
boycott you.
Boycott me, but at this point, I really don't care. I'm beyond that completely. It doesn't matter at all to me. And most of the poets, I have no respect for them anyway. It doesn't mean anything.
It's remarkable to me that although you have a very un-PC reputation now, there are a number of poets and writers who praise you to the skies, but we've never had any trouble finding glowing blurbs for your books. And I think that that's a rather encouraging sign that political correctness is not so powerful within in the realm of poetry, that there are not people who are willing to stand up for quality verse.
Well, something that's curious, if you go to Amazon.com, you'll see I had an early book. It was called The Golem of Gleiditz. The print run for this was ridiculously small. It was only for friends. And I sent it to Amazon.com, and some Jew wrote a review of it. And he came to the conclusion without reading it that it's a book about Jews suffering in Auschwitz. Have you read that review?
No, I haven't read that review.
Well, it's curious if they think you're one of them, how they will try to help you out. The book has nothing to do with them, you know. He never read it because there weren't enough copies distributed, so I know he never had a copy. But anyway, getting back to the topic, a lot of people do praise me. Nobody's ever put me down as a poet. They'll try to demonize me, say I'm an evil person, et cetera, et cetera. And they'll say that my poems are full of tirades and racism, and stuff like this has no effect on me at all. I'm a racialist, you know. I believe there is a difference between the races, and I'm not embarrassed of it, and there's nothing to be embarrassed of. So for me, it doesn't have any effect at all. I don't feel guilty when they do this. For me, it's so what, you know. Everybody in my town that I grew up with felt the same way I do. So it doesn't really matter.
Yeah, you do not have to go too far back into history before every sensible person held views that are similar to our tiny minority viewpoint today.
I grew up in a working class area, and I think these people still hold these views, but if it's going to affect your family and your life, if you can lose your job, if you can lose everything, if you can be ostracized, then you're not going to say publicly what you really believe. And that's what it comes down to. People want to survive. They want to have kids. They want to have a family.
Right.
And if you're an open national socialist, you're going to be under scrutiny. You're going to be under attack, and your livelihood can be threatened. And that's what it comes down to.
Right.
In my case, I feel I'm at the end of my life. I'm in Europe. I'm in a country that doesn't really speak English. And so I'm really not worried. And I really have no intentions to come back to the States unless I have to.
Right.
Well, I am basically, I don't care. Even though there are laws here, if you openly express white nationalist views, you can be accused of a crime. What's it called? Disseminating racial hatred. This law was installed in 2005 when Poland was entering the European Union. A lot of people here don't know about that. That there are laws like this. All of these laws were put into place, and you can be charged. So you can't say things that you can say in the States and Europe. That's why I'm very careful on the website not to mention names.
Right.
When we had our first interview, you have to be careful.
The United States actually imposes these laws which violate the First Amendment of the U.S. Constitution. They actually demanded that countries adopt laws like this as conditions for being part of NATO or the EU.
I don't know if the United States does it, but I know that a certain lobby in the United States puts pressure on politicians to put these sort of measures through.
Right, right.
That's what it comes down to. I still believe in a lot of American, you know, virtues, and when I say American, I don't think it applies to them.
Right, I'm talking about the American government.
Yeah, the American government, certainly, and the whole European Union is this way. You know, basically, for instance, I was recently looking at some German, this is off the topic, and I often go off the topic of German films. They say German journalists in Poland, the German media, and I always tell people there is no German media. Do you really think after World War II they let Germans have their own media?
Right.
This is something that's done here in Europe, the French media, the German media, the English media. There is no English media. There is no German media. There's one media, and there's one type of people who control it. And if you believe otherwise, then you're naive. But people here don't understand that.
Exactly. I remember years ago, it was at the very beginning of Iraq War in 2003. I had this student earnestly asking, where's our liberal media? What happened to our liberal media? They're all in bed with, right, the military and the establishment. And I said, you have to understand, we don't have a liberal media. We have a Jewish media. And, you know, where liberalism conflicts with the Jewish agenda, the Jewish agenda always triumphs. And he was rather taken aback by that, but it took me about 30 seconds to convince him of it with a few well-chosen examples.
The psychological damage that's been done to us, the brainwashing is so strong that it's very difficult to free oneself from the shackles and to unshutter one's eyes. I just wanted to say that the word liberal in the 19th century sense of, in Europe, for instance, liberal doesn't mean leftist. Liberal means somebody who's a capitalist, somebody who's a free thinker. We call them here leftists. In the States, you call leftist liberals. And so a liberal in the 19th century sense of the word was something good. It was somebody with an open mind, somebody who was a free thinker, free enterprise, a supporter of free enterprise, of entrepreneurship. But in the States, a liberal, of course, is a pinko, is a leftist. It's true, of course, that people believe that there's some sort of industrial complex. I remember having sociology classes in the 1980s and hearing about this nonsense, as if the generals are all behind everything and the arms industry is behind everything. But people believe that.
Yeah, I remember when the sale of fighter jets to Saudi Arabia was vetoed after strenuous lobbying by Israel. And I always used to trot that out as the most elegant proof that it wasn't the armament industry that had the final say in American foreign policy. It was the Jewish lobby. So, Leo, tell me how you came about your political awakening. How did you arrive at your convictions? You mentioned listening to William Pierce. Who are some of your influences in that area, and how do you describe your political stance?
Well, of course, like most poets, in the beginning I had a... Of course, I grew up in a hard working class neighborhood, and there you really had your psychological view established. But when you go to college, you start to listen to liberal professors, sociologists, in the humanities especially, science professors usually are pretty stable-minded, but these humanity professors, English professors, literature professors, they sort of change your worldview, because you won't get an A if you don't write what they want you to write. If you don't write from their perspective, you won't get an A. So you start to realize to get an A or to get published, you have to think a certain way. You have to think in the leftist sort of way. And so for about 10 years, I did that. I wrote from a modernist point of view. I would even say some of my early poems are degenerate, the same way that Gottfried Benn's early poems were degenerate. And I didn't put them in my Journey Late at Night. And I'm getting back to where my worldview is. So around 1999, I started thinking about all of this, and I started to come to terms with what I really believe and what I have to do to get ahead. And I was doing some research on the Katyn massacre, and I came upon an article by Dr. Pierce. And immediately when I heard Dr. Pierce, I said, oh, this can't be true, what he's saying. I can't believe this. And so I just listened to the evidence, did some research. And the more I delved into this, the more I realized who was behind the Russian Revolution, who was behind all of these liberal movements. And it was clear, it was obvious, but it took about a year. And it was very difficult to unshutter my eyes, but finally I did it. Around 2002, I was completely free of those liberal ideas. Let's call them liberal leftist thinking, these leftist ideas, and I was free. And that's where my worldview, just my childhood view and then my philosophical views came together. And basically, I discovered the international socialist in myself. And basically, we all have that in us. And what's curious, Jews can often recognize it in us before we do. Oh, you're a Nazi, you're this. You understand what I'm saying? And they often do this. And that's basically where I am. I have no regrets about anything, as Hess said. I have no regrets, and I'm basically 100% dedicated to this. What's going to happen, I don't know. I have little influence. I'm just a poet. And I try to talk to young people. I think it's a waste of time convincing older people about this, because they have no influence at all. It's only the young. Only the young matter. If you can convince a 60-year-old man that you're right, what's he going to do? How can he influence the world? He can't, unless he has money. So I basically deal with young people, and I try to convince them. I try to convince every young couple I meet, white couple, to have children. These are the things I try to do. These are the things that are I don't try to teach them how to become a skinhead or to join some group. Have children, raise a family, and make your children conscious of what's going on. That's all I try to. That's what I basically try to do right now. And that's my philosophy is to deal with regular people and to affect them in life.
So, have you shared your ideas with your own family?
I have, but my kids basically, they're teenagers, and so they're in their own little world. And recently I had a discussion about what's taking place in Europe, and my youngest son says he hates blacks and Arabs. My cat just jumped on my back. I have to let him out of the room. Well, I have scratches all over my back from this cat. I tolerate his excesses. But returning to the topic, and I tried to explain to them why there are blacks and Arabs in Europe, and he just couldn't quite understand it. He says, well, I don't see any Jews in Europe, and I don't see they're causing problems. It's difficult to do, and I don't think everybody can quite understand it. Who is behind this? And I don't even think it's necessary that we make our people conscious of who's behind it. We have to know, and we have to promote families, encourage our people to have children, and to vote responsibly or to manifest responsibly or to protest responsibly. I don't think people can basically comprehend it because they can't see it.
Right.
You can't get it across, and I don't think 1930s propaganda from Germany will work either anymore in the age of the internet.
Right.
This is only something for the elite to comprehend, in my opinion. Just as the Jews don't go every day. We should concentrate on the sufferings of our people, which is what I try to, which what I've been trying to do, to emphasize what the communists did to us, what took place, what liberalism has been doing to us. But the problem is in the States, there's always some conservative in there and who wants to bring in a black or a Jew to show that it's all inclusive. And that's the problem in the United States. I don't have a solution, to what to do. But I do know that not everybody can understand, and not even my own kids understand it, even though I try to explain to them. You need a historical context, you need to know history, you need to know philosophy, you understand all these intellectual movements, and the average person can't do this.
It must be somewhat awkward for you to hold the political views that you do living in a country like Poland, because, of course, the first thing people are going to associate with your views is National Socialism, World War II, and Poland tragically suffered terribly during that time. So how do you deal with that? And do you know other Poles, other people in Poland, who are somewhat sympathetic to some of the principles but have to deal with this issue of the unpleasantness, the war?
My view of Polish history is a little bit different. When I grew up, I had this idea that Poles were this brave people that fought against tyrants and are very noble. But having lived here 20 years, 25 years, my view is a little bit different. I don't know. I don't know if Poles are so noble and so great and so good. But they're not bad, certainly. And there are Aryans. And are there Poles that have views similar to mine? Most Poles think the way I do, it's just that you can't talk about it openly, and they don't do it. But if you speak to a Polish nationalist, he'll, of course, defend Poland. If you speak this, but there are very few European nationalists, and this is the problem. There are those petty nationalists who understand the Jewish problem, but they're always looking at it from a Polish perspective. And I always tell them, Poland can't exist if Europe doesn't exist, and Poland can't exist if European people don't exist. Poland is dependent upon those other countries. And the problem is Poles always put Poland first before the biggest problem, which is the problem of immigration. And they will do anything for Poland to exist at the cost of other nations. That's the biggest problem. Yeah. And I'm not a Polish nationalist. I'm a European nationalist, not a European Union nationalist, but a European nationalist, a white nationalist. And I believe that the most important thing is that we as a people survive, and not just that one nation survives at the cost of the other nation. So when we go back to World War II, I look in retrospect, and it's obvious that Poland should have fought on the other side, and should have, if Piłsudski was alive, the Polish leader, probably that's what would have taken place. But unfortunately, he died, and the Polish colonels took power, and they believed the English promises of support, the French and English promises of support, and they went to that side, and the war started. And I think Hitler did what he had to do, unfortunately. He had to have some bumper space between the Soviet Union and Germany, and he got it. I don't really have any contacts here. I'm not a person who joins a group. I would probably irritate most people. I'm a loner. I'm a free thinker, and I think what I think, and I believe I can influence more people as a poet than I could as an activist or as a member of some organization. So I don't get involved, but I do talk to Poles on the street or older Poles about what took place during World War II, and everybody's conscious of the Jewish role in communism and the role in the destruction of Poland after the war, and they basically controlled Poland. Now, something curious, this is off the topic, but I wanted to mention this. Do you know who Felix Dzerzhinsky was? Well, it's a myth that he was a Pole. He was a Polish noble. But if you look at his face, and you look at Piłsudski's face, and they both came from the same, they went to the same school. I don't know if they came from the same town. Piłsudski has an Aryan face with a high forehead, with an eagle nose. And Dzerzhinsky has a hook nose. Now, I did a little bit of research recently, and it turns out that he knew Yiddish as a child. That he spoke Yiddish. He spoke fluent Polish, Yiddish, Latin. Even though he was baptized, he was a Catholic, his father, it turns out, was one of those Jews who bought a name, bought some land, and called himself a noble. This took place in Poland. So, yes, his father was a landowner, and he theoretically came from a landowner family, and he theoretically had a title of noble. But you could back in those days, there were no ways to check. And so in my research, I found that his father was a Jew that Polonized and then became a Catholic. But of course, Jews will say he was a Pole, and the communists will say he was a Pole. But this is just something curious on the side. And most Poles know this. Most Poles know that Dzerzhinsky, most conscious Poles know that he was a Jew. Now, if you have a droplet of Jewish blood in you, for me, you're a Jew, and that's what it comes down to in the end. Curious, right? Did you know that?
No, I did not know that.
This is something recently I've been doing, and I look through a lot of sources. I go back, and I just look. If you have these kind of features in your face, it's impossible that there's somewhere down the line that you are 100% Aryan. It's impossible. And this has an influence. Do you really think the Jewish communists like Lenin and Trotsky and Kamenev would let Dzerzhinsky become the Minister of Interior or the founder of the Cheka, if you weren't one of them? That they're going to let some Polish noble come to this Russia who didn't take part in the revolution, and suddenly he gets this high role, this high position in the party. They only let their own in, the people they can trust, one of their own. And that's basically what took place. They don't let some Polish guy, some Polish noble come to Russia and suddenly become so powerful.
You talk about how you think that you can have a great influence through poetry, or greater influence than joining.
Not a great poet, but a greater influence than if I were an activist, because I probably irritate most people, and that's what it comes down to.
Okay. Well, you know, I don't play well with others either, so I totally understand that.
I think at this point, those organizations help. It basically doesn't help. But basically, if you have one person with good skills in the internet, who knows how to work with WordPress, who knows cascading style sheets, who knows how to make audio videos, who knows how to make videos, who knows how to do all of this stuff, who knows how to edit internet productions, can do much more than some organization. Unfortunately, not everyone knows. I mean, I'm very, very competent in cascading style sheets. I redesign my sites constantly, and I also work in this area. I don't know how to use cell phones well, but I do know how to design websites.
Has any of your poetry ever been set to music?
Actually, there was a composer from Australia once who wrote me that he wanted to use one of my poems. But probably at that time, there was a great protest against me. He probably Googled my name, and he found out that I have politically incorrect views, and I didn't hear from him again. This often happens. People will write to me and praise me how much they love my poetry, and then some other poet will tell them, oh, he has these views, you shouldn't, you know, like his poetry. Something like that will happen, usually. So, but I'm always very, very wary when somebody contacts me and wants something. Usually if it's an artist, that artist wants me to praise them. And I don't like to praise. Or they want something. They want something that it's, nothing is for free. So basically I ignore most people. And I didn't ignore you because basically there was something more important involved, our people.
Right.
But I ignore poets write me every day. I get letters from poets asking me to evaluate their poetry, and I really don't care about their poetry. I'm more interested in the survival of our people, and this is the most important thing to me. So yes, I have received requests to put my poetry to music.
Because that is really one way that words can become more influential, more emotionally powerful, and more widely known is if they're put to music. If you had a choice of any historical composer or songwriter to set your poetry to music, who would you choose?
Well, it would be a Polish bard who, of course, unfortunately claimed to have Jewish ancestry, but still he was quite anti-communist. And his name was Jacek Kaczmarski. He was a Polish bard, wrote anti-communist songs within a historical context. He died of cancer a few years ago when he was 52 or 53. Basically, I would have loved to have him put my songs to music, and he would have done a good job. And actually, I was quite influenced by him in doing this, because he gave me a sort of paradigm of how to do it. And he was a very competent poet. He was not just a bard, a singer, or a guitarist. He was a good poet. But you don't know his name, but after we finish, I'll write it in chat. And you could see some of his songs. In the English world, I don't know. I mean, I like Baroque music, but I don't think it will go with my poetry.
Yeah, that might be a somewhat odd fit.
I don't like romantic music. I don't like Chopin. That's too sentimental for me. Really, Baroque is my favorite period. And literature, too, I like Baroque poetry. In fact, I consider myself to be a neo-metaphysical or neo-Baroque poet when I don't write about historical themes. And there are often conceits in my poetry. It's a different style of poetry. It's certainly not in fashion. It hasn't been in fashion for 300 years.
So let's talk about some of the themes that I find in your poetry. You have a lot of poems that deal with death. They're very, very powerful. I really enjoyed editing your books, but I had to do it slowly because they were somewhat emotionally brutal when you really, really read them carefully and sort of felt everything that's being communicated there. One thing I guess I'd like to ask you is, what are your religious views? They seem somewhat Catholic in language, but not necessarily in conviction.
Well, I think Catholicism, Wallace Stevens understood that Catholicism offers you a good tradition to build upon, words, power. And I grew up a Catholic. My father's a Catholic. My mother's a Catholic. And so this is in me. But, you know, and there was a time actually I contemplated becoming a priest when I was about 22. But I liked women too much. And I liked sex too much. There's a psychological process that takes place. I'll contemplate on something for a year, half a year, a few months, or over a period of maybe 10 years. And then suddenly one day I'll sit down and I can't stop. I'm compelled to write and the words come. And I'll spend 3 days on one poem. I'll make a first draft, and then I'll rework it until it's completely correct, exactly the way I want it. And I don't really sit down and think I'm going to write about something. I don't know what I'm going to write about. If I sit down and write about the murder of the Tsars, it just came to me. It just came to me. I was curious. I knew who had killed the Tsars intuitively. Then I delved into it, and I thought about it. And then 6 months later, the poem came one day after some coffee. So I don't sit down and think I'm going to write about something. I write about death because this is something that we all have to do. Death is not popular today at all, by the way. But all serious poets have to write about death. I also write about themes with an existential background. I think those are the themes that dominate my poetry. That's the theme that dominates my poetry, death. Death, basically, the death of our people, our own deaths. And you ask about my religious views. At this point, my religious views, I believe there is a creator. I don't think he's human. I don't think it's even an it. The universe is vast. As you know, the universe is ever expanding. And we live in a galaxy with millions and millions of stellar systems or solar systems. And within each solar system, there's a high chance that there's a planet that has the same conditions that we have, that has water, that has a temperature between 10 and 30 degrees. In other words, there's life teeming all through the universe. And we live on this tiny blue planet at the end of the galaxy. at the edge of our, on the periphery of the galaxy. So God doesn't just deal with us, and he doesn't impose his moral laws upon us. The laws are in nature. They're there. They're obvious to see. We can see nature, that certain things are accepted and some things aren't. Homosexuality is not accepted in nature. It's a way for nature to weed unhealthy genes out. It exists, but it's not something that's accepted. So what I'm getting back to, I believe that there is a supreme creator who basically sets everything in place beyond time, and the universe is. But he doesn't just deal with us. In other words, what I'm saying is there is God, but we can't quite comprehend what he is. And if you think you know what God is or who he is, then you're lying. You have, it's impossible to know what God is from a human perspective because we're just humble animals ourselves. We are very limited in our understanding of things. I'm sure there are superior creatures in the cosmos. Then, of course, they're too far away. But the whole point is, for me, God is not human. I don't believe Christ was God. I don't believe that God manifests himself here on earth. That's what I believe today. And I don't believe I'm going to be punished for it. But I do believe that there are obvious laws here that can be obeyed that are clear and obvious. One of them is to stay faithful to your race, to die for your people. That's one of the biggest honors you can do as a man, is to die for your people and for your family. And that's clear and obvious to me. That's always been clear to all people. Even to black people, it's clear that they have to stay loyal to their own people. It's clear to Jews, for sure. But for some reason, among our people, everybody, the weakest among us are the easiest people to be manipulated, in my opinion. Basically, I don't think I'm an atheist, but I don't know what I am. I don't know, but I know that there is, maybe this is just one computer program. I don't know, but I do know that we cannot comprehend what God is. We can't say what he is because it's just beyond our understanding.
In a number of your poems, you refer to philosophers, Wittgenstein, Plato, Heraclitus. It seems like you've done a lot of reading in philosophy. Can you tell us about your, if you will, philosophical convictions, your philosophical reading, and how this influences your poetry?
Well, earlier when I was in my religious phase, of course, I really never was faithful to traditional Catholicism. And I was interested in the heretics and the heresies, Manichaeism and Gnosticism and all those things. But then I went back and I read the pre-Socratic philosophers. I read Plato. I read Socrates. I read the Neoplatonic philosophers, Origen. I read all through the beginning of Western philosophy up until the end of the 19th century. I'm not interested in 20th century philosophy, up until the existentialists. And basically, as I think Goethe said, all poets have to know philosophy, but they shouldn't put it in their poetry. And I think that's what it comes down to. But I don't think at this point in my life, at my age, I could sit down and have an intelligent discussion about philosophy. It's in my head, but it's in a poet's head, and it's not in a philosopher's head. I'm not a politician or a philosopher or a political thinker. I'm a poet. And so these things are in my head in phrases, and they come to me, and I verify them. And if it sounds right, I'll use it. That's what it comes down to. So I don't really have a philosophical view, a point of view. I know I like the existentialists. I like the 19th century philosophers, not Marx, not Engels, but I like Kierkegaard a lot. I like In Fear and Trembling, the idea of this. And basically, that's what it comes down to. Wittgenstein, I just use him as a curiosity because George Trakl, I don't know if you know his story, the Austrian poet who wrote in German. He was of Czech ancestry. He was he dropped out of school early and he started taking drugs. And of course, the easiest way to get drugs at that time was to become a pharmacologist. So he became a pharmacologist's assistant, and he worked in a what they call a chemist store here in Europe. I guess it's a drug store in the States. And then in 1910, he enlisted in the army and he worked as an orderly. When World War I started, he was in what is today Western Poland. He was stationed in a town called Grodek. And there he had to attend to about 80 wounded soldiers who were greatly disfigured, lacking limbs and, screaming in agony. And he went crazy. And they sent him to Krakow and they put him in a military hospital. And meanwhile, he was getting a stipendium. He was getting some money from Wittgenstein, who was a rich philosopher, by the way, who had Jewish blood in him, unfortunately. And as you know, that Wittgenstein was a philosopher that in the beginning was very logical, and then he became transcendental in his thinking. And Trakh asked him to help him, and Wittgenstein took a train from Vienna to Krakow, which was part of the Austrian Empire at the time. And when he arrived in Krakow, he learned that Trakh had committed suicide. So I just instilled that in him because it's curious. It's a curious thing. It's just interesting. And so that's why I use philosophy. Or about Immanuel Kant. Everybody knows that Immanuel Kant only lived in Königsberg, which today I think is called Kaliningrad, Russian. The area that was once Prussia, which is completely devastated, by the way. And he would walk to work every day, and people used to set their clocks according to the time he would go to the university. He would walk by every day at the same time. And these are just curious things. I don't even know if philosophy is in there, but basically I just know about their lives. I know about the lives of philosophers and the lives of poets. I know how most of them died. Either they drank themselves to death or shot themselves or hanged themselves. Or very few poets died happily and with natural deaths.
So do you write only in English, or do you write in other languages as well?
I translate from other languages, and when I translate, people, oh, this is not a literal, of course it's not a literal. They say, oh, this is not a literal translation. Of course it's not a literal translation, because the literal translation doesn't sound good. If you know anything about translation, you're trying to recreate a poem in another language, so it's effective in that other language. My translation of Lermontov, The Dream, and somebody mentioned that Nabokov, who, by the way, was a philo-Semite, and I think he was a Jew, his translation is terrible. You know, a real poet rhymes on concrete nouns. That's the first thing you have to do if you know anything about poetry. You don't rhyme on adjectives. You don't write on abstract nouns. You have to rhyme on concrete nouns, and about 60% of the time. And if you read Nabokov's translation of The Dream, these are just amateurish rhymes. He doesn't know anything. In fact, he wasn't a very good writer at all, but he was promoted at the time by the Jewish establishment because he was philo-Semitic, and I think maybe had a Jewish lover. I wanted to mention that on the forum there was a discussion about Nabokov, but his translation is not good at all. And of course he hated Dostoevsky, Nabokov. He complained that Dostoevsky didn't give any description of nature, but Dostoevsky was Jew-wise, and that's why he hated him. That's the reason. Dostoevsky was on to the Jews, and every writer worth his salt was on to the Jews. If you think about it, every writer who was really someone you can trust and believe was on to the Jews. And Nabokov is not the kind of writer. He wrote a pedophilic novel about Lolita, right? So anyway, that's just a curiosity, something on the side that we can mention or in a casual conversation. But I wanted to mention that in the forum, but I thought, why do it? And I remember these things, and I have to go back and verify them to see if I'm correct. And I went back that day, and I actually checked on Nabokov, and I'm right. He was philo-Semitic. And that's why he was promoted in the Western world. He didn't even know English. He didn't know English that well, and he would write in English. Somebody probably rewrote his novel. Or Jerzy Kuczynski. Do you know who Jerzy Kuczynski was?
Oh, yes.
So he wrote this terrible book, The Painted Bird, about Poles who mistreated him during the war. I mean, it's a novel, so it's not a biography. But still, people take it as a biography. But he didn't even write this book. He had a ghostwriter do it, Kuczynski, who, by the way, was a pervert. I think he used to go to sadomasochist clubs in New York City. And in the end, I think he killed himself in some sadomasochistic way. But he was promoted as a great writer, Jerzy Kuczynski, The Painted Bird. I remember when I was a student, we had to read this. When I was in high school, I had to read Black Boy. What was the name of that black writer who wrote that? Yeah, but we had to read this kind of stuff in high school about how he almost raped a white woman and he put her body in a furnace. And you're reading this when you're 16 years old, and I went to a school that was half black. So, you know, this, I always used to wonder in those days, back in the 70s, why TV reality, Bill Cosby reality, is different than the reality that I experience in everyday life, you know. But, it, you know, finally, as I said, it all comes together in the end. You have to be a man, and you have to hold a worldview that's consistent with your psychology, your psychological framework, what you really believe. And that's why I'm 100% happy and content with myself. I don't have to live in conflict and do things that I don't believe or say things that I don't believe. These are just – oh, go ahead, please.
When I met Dr. Pierce in 2001, – he said to me something that I'll never forget. He said that it was really very difficult for him psychologically to give up science, but nothing could compare to the freedom to spend his entire life speaking the truth as he saw it and not having to dissemble or hide his views anymore. And I do think that people who have to spend their lives lying to others and hiding their views have a great deal of internal conflict, which is tiring to them. You know, when you're always fighting yourself, you're exhausting yourself. And when you finally stop fighting with yourself, then suddenly you find this enormous energy there that you can put to use. And so I feel that way. I think Pierce felt that way. I hope that you feel that way too, because you've done tremendous things.
Well, I live in fear of too, of losing my livelihood. I have a livelihood. I won't mention what it is. But if I do lose that livelihood, I don't imagine myself getting a job if I go back to the States. Somebody will Google my name. And so the biggest fear right now is losing my livelihood. I have a family. I have a flat in Krakow now, which it takes a lot of. I'm not living there at the moment, but I'll move there when it gets warmer. It has a furnace that uses 3,000 kilowatts of energy. So it's just too much for me, and I don't feel like warming the place or heating it. But this is an aside. So this is something that I take seriously too, but I'm 52 years old. I know I could die at any moment, and it gives me strength. In fact, if I would die suddenly, it would be a great thing. You know, I wouldn't have to worry. But I do understand people who have these conflicts. But you see, this is not a way to live. You have to stand up. You have to stand up even if you lose everything, and you have to do this. This is something you have to do for yourself. And if you don't do it, you're going to live in fear, and you're going to be... It's sort of like being, I don't know what it's like to be a drag queen, but I would compare it to that. You're living an effeminate lifestyle, a lifestyle that belittles you, that your wife doesn't respect you, your family doesn't respect you. If you don't defend your family and your wife, she'll feel it, she'll know it, and your family will know it, and you have to do that. So if you're running in fear your whole life, you won't be able to accomplish anything. And it will give you freedom if you do hold your point of view, but you have to be strong. You may be in prison, you may be executed. We don't know what's going to happen in the near future. You may be sent to a gulag. But the problem is, once you're separated from people who believe what you believe, you'll be bombarded with negative epithets every day. You'll be called names. People will tell you that you're this every day of your life, that you're this, that you're something bad, that you're something evil. And you have to be strong. You have to remember who and what you are. And they'll do this. You'll be bombarded. It's like somebody being bullied at school. And they'll bully you. They'll tell you. They'll demonize you. They'll do this to you. And when you're not among your own, can you stand up? Now, I notice many people who were in this movement buckled under in the end. They gave in. They couldn't take it. Without the support, without reading, they couldn't do it. But you have to do it. You have to remain strong. So if you're going to do this, you have to do it 100%. You can't turn back. What was the name of the group, the leader of the group? What's his name? From Canada. The Canadian singer who became an anti-racist. Birdie.
Birdie, yeah.
This is an example. This man must be, I mean, I know he's sympathetic still, but basically he couldn't put up with it. He couldn't put up with the pressure. Of being a white nationalist. So he found himself an Indian girlfriend, a Hindu girlfriend, and he claims he's not a racist. And I don't think people are racist. I think we're racialist. That doesn't mean we want to get up in the morning and tell a black man he can't have a livelihood. We just don't want to live among them. We don't want to be among them, and we don't want to be with them. We want our own societies with our own people, with our own worldview, with our own governments. It doesn't mean that we don't want a government to exist in the Congo that does the same thing. And Birdie basically did this. He wrote some good songs, but he couldn't stand the pressure, and he gave in. And he didn't do anything wrong. He wasn't somebody who threatened a judge by accident. You know, he didn't have an informant. Basically, he did what he did, and then he couldn't stand up to the pressure. He couldn't be browbeaten every day. He couldn't take it. He said his family was under attack, and if that's what's going to happen to you. And people think it's like the Soviet Union in the 1930s, but not that bad yet. When they would come around in the so-called Black Ravens, the cars that would be used to pick when they were arresting people, when they were making mass arrests and executions. And Solzhenitsyn wrote that at that time, if people stopped, if they went out on the street and grabbed these security agents from the NKVD, in Polish NKVD in Russian too, if they stopped them, if they beat them up and killed them, it would have stopped immediately. But people stayed in their houses, they were afraid, and they didn't do anything. And the arrests took place, the mass deportations to Siberia, the millions of people who died, it took place. People today don't even know about this. They can't believe this is real, and it was real. And this is what might take place in the West, too. It might take, at least in the United States. I don't know if it will take place in Western Europe. I read the Bible many times, of course, the Old Testament, the New Testament, but my father told me, don't do it because it's going to make you crazy. And it didn't make me crazy, but it made me realize that the Old Testament is totally, it's insane. The New Testament, there's a sort of, some psychological good reasoning in the New Testament, but again, I agree that it makes us too passive, turning the other cheek and being it. Basically, it's true.
So, Leo, tell us about your current projects and projects that you're planning to work on.
Well, at the moment, I'm contemplating, and I've been contemplating about communism, but this wouldn't be poetry. About, for instance, here in this town, by the way, there's a very interesting book called An Eye for an Eye. I don't know if you can find a copy. The person who wrote it was a Jew named John Sachs, I can't remember. And he was a pretty famous journalist who wrote about Vietnam in the 1960s. And he came here in the 1980s. And he discovered that the leaders of the security forces here after World War II, immediately after World War II, were Jewish, and that they were torturing local people. Of course, he justified it because he said they had been in Auschwitz, but basically this is what Jews have been doing everywhere. And I would like to go back and uncover this material and do research on it. And write about the whole influence, what took place here. I'm really interested what took place here. I'm not interested in the so-called Holocaust, if it took place or didn't take place. I really don't care. People, what do you think about? I don't think anything. I don't care. But I really don't care. I don't want to touch it. It's not my problem. But there was a real genocide, and it's a genocide because it was the murder of the cream of the crop, first of all. It was genocide because they murdered the blue bloods. They murdered our best. The flower of our nations, they murdered them. Our professors, our natural leaders. People think, well, he's a noble. He just sat on his ass and didn't do anything. Well, this is somebody who came from your blood. His people were once peasants, and they rose up in the ranks. They fought, and they became nobles. But these were your natural leaders. And back then, in the 17th century, if your noble was bad to the peasants, they would kill him. They would basically execute him. And what I'm trying to say, they were our organic leaders. They were our natural leaders. If it was the Kaiser or if it were the Queen of England or whatever, I know they also were in cahoots with the Jews. But my point is that the nobles were our organic leaders. These leaders are gone. All the intellectuals are gone in Eastern Europe and in Western Europe to a certain extent. And everybody now is politically correct. All of our politicians are smiling idiots. So I would like to go back and delve into this material about communists here and what took place here and the murders here. And maybe, I don't know if it's within my range as an intellectual. I don't even know if I am an intellectual. I don't know if I can do it, but I would like to do it. It's easier for me to do it in poetry because I could make a sort of a cinematographic picture, an image of what took place, for instance, the murder of the Tsars. And you can imagine what took place that moment. That's easier for me to do, to write a story than to write a historical account of what took place, even though I was trained to do that. So that's what I would like to do, if I survive.
Well, Leo, this has been a fascinating conversation. I really appreciate you taking the time, and I look forward to all of your future work. I hope you will always consider Countercurrents as a welcome home for your writing, whether it's poetry or essays or histories. So thank you very much.
Thank you, too, for having me on.
Countercurrents Radio is the voice of Countercurrents Publishing and the North American New Right. Visit us at www.countercurrents.com. That's counter-currents.com.